Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our episode today is brought to you by Quip and by Grove Collaborative. And of course, today marks the beginning of the public phase of the impeachment hearings. And this, you know, really, with all the hype and everything, it's everything is hype. But you have to step back and realize this is kind of an historic moment. You have the public impeachment testimony of the President of the United States. This has only happened twice before in the modern era. This is the first time in the modern political ecosystem that we're having something like this. And it's going to run for several weeks, but it was dramatic. And of course, the first star witness, and we are recording this midday, is the actual ambassador to Ukraine, who is still there, remarkably, William Taylor, a man who served his country for 50 years. And he delivered, I thought, rather compelling testimony. But here's the soundbite that everybody's going to be talking about, directly tying President Trump to a conversation about the investigation, the investigations, the day after his phone call with the Ukrainian president. Here's what he had to say.
Last Friday, a member of my staff told me of events that occurred on July 26th. While Ambassador Volker and I visited the front, this member of my staff accompanied Ambassador Sondland. Ambassador Sondland met with Mr. Yermak. Following that meeting, in the presence of my staff, at a restaurant, Ambassador Sondland called President Trump and told him of his meetings in Kyiv. The member of my staff could hear President Trump on the phone asking Ambassador Sondland about the investigations. Ambassador Sondland told President Trump the Ukrainians were ready to move forward. Following the call with President Trump, the member of my staff asked Ambassador Sondland what President Trump thought about Ukraine. Ambassador Sondland responded that President Trump cares more about the investigations of Biden, which Giuliani was pressing for. At the time I gave my deposition on October 22nd, I was not aware of this information. I'm including it here for completeness. As the committee knows, I reported this information through counsel to the State Department's legal advisor, as well as to counsel for both the majority and the minority of this committee. It is my understanding that the committee is following up on this matter. Mr. Chairman, I recognize that this is rather a lengthy recitation of the events of the past few months, told from my vantage point in Kyiv. But I also recognize the importance of the matters your committee is investigating. And I hope that this chronology will provide some framework for your questions. As I mentioned in my October 22nd deposition.
And of course, we have the usual circus atmosphere of these hearings, which is inevitable, I suppose. So joining us is one of our former colleagues from the Weekly Standard and now one of the editors at Commentary, Christine Rosen. Welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So quick and dirty analysis of the first half day of this. I had very, very low expectations when it began, when the Republicans began interrupting in the first, I think, 1 minute of the proceedings. But then it proceeded. And I'll just take what one of my takeaways was that the Democrats got what they were hoping for from Taylor. Actually, what I meant to say was that William Taylor's testimony was what they hoped that Mueller's testimony had been, and wasn't. The guy really, I thought, was a made for television witness, which of course doesn't necessarily change the dynamics. But what were your thoughts?
No, I agree. I think he's behaved well. They obviously, the goal of the Democrats with these hearings is to have as streamlined, straightforward, and simple a narrative to sell to the American people as possible. You know, they've already heard this testimony behind closed doors. So this is a kind of performance for the American public. So really the only thing to watch is whether the poll numbers move. So, right, you know, there was a morning consult poll out this morning. People have not budged much on impeachment. There's still only about 8% of the people who responded to the poll saying they might change their minds. So the country's still evenly divided on this issue. The next 2 weeks we'll see, first of all, how many people actually tune in and follow this who aren't like us political junkies. You know, how much of the message of these hearings sinks in, and whose narrative is the most powerful. Because I think what the Republicans have obviously tried the tactic they're taking is to kind of be contemptuous of the whole process. Personally, I think that's a mistake, but they must have made some sort of calculation that this is the horse they're going to ride.
It is the calculation, and maybe it's because they don't really have better options, because we're going into this and they haven't really settled on what their defense is, right? I mean, there's right. various defenses. There is the Trump authorized defense, which is there's nothing wrong. It was absolutely perfect. There was no quid pro quo. There are other people who say, well, yes, there was a quid pro quo, and there's nothing wrong with all of that. Or there are people who say, yeah, it's disturbing, it's out of bounds, but it's not impeachable. But the problem with those is that they're kind of mutually exclusive, and they haven't done this. So, yeah, I think your point is exactly right. This is this historic, august constitutional proceeding, and it's in the interest of the Devin Nunes's of the world to make it appear to be trivial, to try to discredit it. But here's the problem. This list of witnesses is rather extraordinary, because these are not political types. These are not the Corey Lewandowskis. These are not the sketchy types that we've seen in the past. These are solid career professionals with long records of service. And even more damaging, that most of them are, at least so far, are appointees of the Trump administration itself. I mean, these are the calls from within the House.
Precisely. And I think that's where this Republican strategy could be quite a gamble, because they if they try to smear some of these witnesses, which we know they will, because they did that, you know, they've already done that about the witnesses who've appeared behind closed doors, they risk basically... they're questioning the judgment of Trump himself, because these are people who have worked for Trump. So it's a very difficult needle for them to thread. However, what I will say, the difference between now and when Clinton was impeached, even in terms of the media ecosphere, is dramatic. So I'll be very curious to see how many people tune in over the course of 2 weeks. 2 weeks in modern Twitter era time is a very different experience of time than even it was in the 90s when we had some cable news covering the Clinton impeachment.
That's like geologic time.
when you
think about it. No, I agree with you completely on all of this. I tend to be a skeptic that this will in fact move public opinion, which just appears to be rock solid. However, we have not seen anything like this in many, many years. So that is, of course, the big unknown. But anyone who thinks that even this compelling testimony is going to move votes, I think, is somewhat naive. I was home with Nicole Wallace yesterday, and was during the breaking story where she was. I think the report came out that the Trump had been considering firing the Inspector General of the Intelligence Community, and she said, "Well, will this, you know, cause Republicans to rebel? And you know, when will this cause Republicans to rebel?" And I said, "When you and I get unicorns for Christmas." I mean, really, how many times do we have
sparkly
to go?
Sparkly rainbow unicorns.
Exactly. I'm sorry. We've seen this. We know how this play is going to end. I mean, they need to go through all of it. But I do remember, and I need to confess that I did support the Clinton impeachment, and in retrospect, I think that was probably a mistake. But I do remember very distinctly sitting at one of my son's soccer games, reading the Star report.
Oof,
and of course, I would end up spending months, you know, talking about this. And I remember reading this, and my reaction was it's so small, it's mm-hmm. so trivial. It's oral sex and hiding presence, and just it certainly didn't feel like it was going to rise to high crimes and misdemeanors. I don't have this feeling here. This has what the Clinton didn't have. But of course, again, I agree with you. I don't know that it's going to change public opinion. On the other hand, you know, we are just at the beginning of all of this. So, do you have any thoughts about John Bolton and what John Bolton is doing? Are you a bud of John Bolton's?
Yeah, I'm not necessarily a bud. I actually have a lot of admiration for him. He's one of the few people in Washington who, when I was like a young nobody intern, I had a question about the UN, and he took time and answered it and followed up and was just treated me like I was, you know, an equal colleague, even though I was, you know, at the bottom of the totem pole. I have a lot of respect for people in Washington who do that. And his reputation is being one of those kind of people. I think, though, that he also has a lot of respect for the job that he had and the jobs he's performed in the past. I mean, I don't blame him for saying you're going to have to drag me kicking and screaming. He's, you know, I don't think he I don't think there's any love lost between him and congressional Democrats, and particularly on foreign policy matters. So I think he's playing a different game than Trump and the Republicans are playing, but it's the one he needs to play. He's a person of integrity. I expect him to continue to be that, whether he's forced to testify or not. So far, I would say, you know, out of all of the cast of characters, I think it would have been out of character for him to rush to testify. So I think he's playing the hand he's been dealt there.
It is a fascinating story because unlike so many other characters in the modern drama, he's a man who actually believed things. Now you may disagree with what he believed in, but he had a very, very clear agenda that he was committed to and that he regards as very, very important. Number two, he has, and I don't mean this in a pejorative sense at all, he's a man of considerable pride. And so to go into the Trump administration and see those principles and those values trampled upon, and then to go through the meat grinder of humiliation that is part and parcel of going through the Trump administration, he's not reacting the way others have done. He appears to be not intimidated. And I, based on that report of the speech that he gave, the NBC report, he's all out of F's to give. I mean, he's letting his freak flag fly.
Well, and he just inked a book deal, so I'll be curious to see what the book says when it comes out.
Well, see, this is the problem, and of course, he's getting dinged for this, is that he's not willing to testify to the, you know, to Congress, but he's giving these speeches when he's undoubtedly being paid five figures or more, and then of course the lucrative book deal. But does someone like a John Bolton, would his testimony or will his book, will it change the lockstep support of Republicans for Trump? I mean, I'm asking this is that he's somebody that obviously, you know, the resistance despises. Democrats, you know, have done, you know, nothing to support him. But there are a lot of Republicans that are going to take him very, very seriously. And so if he testified, would that move anything?
So pre-Jim Mattis leaving the administration, I would have said yes. But as you saw, I mean, Mattis was fairly critical of Trump as well. And is, you know, like Bolton, someone a lot of mainstream Republicans admire. No, I think that the dynamics of how tribal loyalty among Republicans who support Trump works now means that even, you know, men of integrity who've served their country for a long time, like Bolton, like Mattis, when they raise an alarm bell and they're in the administration, people sort of reassure themselves and say, ah, there's some adults in the room. But once they leave, they're considered disloyal. And they're often obviously trashed by President Trump, which is a horror show of a thing to do to people who've served in your administration. But the loyalists fall in line with Trump. And it's deeply disappointing to see people eager to undermine a lifetime of service that people have given to their country, particularly in the case of Mattis. It angered me. But they are, you know, this is a cult of personality at this point. So if the leader of the cult declares these persona non gratas, then people fall in line.
Never Trump. We have a piece up at the Bulwark today by Laura Field, who talks about these attacks. And because, of course, this is like page one of the playbook. And so we're going to see this. I mean, the moment that John Bolton breaks bad, he's going to be attacked. We saw the willingness of some of the Trump folks to go after Colonel Vindman, who is, you know, talk about an American success story. And when you had my fellow Wisconsinite Sean Duffy smear him, that seemed like a bridge too far for some people in Trump world temporarily. But what Laura Field writes is, though, these attacks on the whistleblower and the other witnesses work to collapse the differences between competing kinds of loyalties. It is the worst kind of moral relativism. And it is this sort of sense that again, it's the cult of personality, but it is sort of this postmodern, there is no truth. We're just simply going to smear anyone who is disloyal, and that every kind of loyalty, the confusion of this personal loyalty to Donald Trump with, you know, patriotic loyalty and service to the Constitution. They're just kind of wiping all this out. She says, setting aside the issue of postmodernism's genuine meaning and value, it's easy to show how the attacks on the impeachment witnesses are cultivating genuinely nihilistic terrain. What it doesn't matter what your service is, who you are, what your integrity, how respected you are, you're just going to go into the barrel.
Well, it's true. And it's one of the great ironies of President Trump's use of power is, you know, we all decry his use of Twitter, but he weirdly, for someone who's supposedly an old school populist and by no stretch of the imagination postmodernist, has fully embraced this postmodern notion of my truth, right? This ridiculous, you know, idea that if I say it's my truth, then you can't question it, even if the facts belie my truth. And, you know, we've seen this on the progressive left escalating over the, particularly in the last few years, but Trump embraces this too. You know, if someone turns on him, his truth is that that person must always have been disloyal, must always have been wrong. It's never that he made poor judgment. It's never that he did something wrong himself. His truth is the ultimate arbiter here, and that is a wildly postmodern idea.
I also love the way everybody just switches on a dime. And when they were doing the closed hearings, these were Soviet style secret proceedings that the Democrats were hiding from the American people. And this morning, you know, the open hearings, Devin Nunes actually essentially says they're bad because they're a televised theatrical performance.
And now it's a show trial, right? Before it was.
let's immediately switch all of this. Okay, I need a ruling on the biggest controversy of the day. Mm-hmm. How do you pronounce the capital of Ukraine?
Well, so right, is it Kiev? Kiev.
Yeah.
I know a few Ukrainians. I will ask them and report back. But
okay, here's what I've been told. Based on my deep research reading Twitter, is that Kiev is the Russian pronunciation, and that the Ukrainians now very consciously want to drop the Russian pronunciation, so they pronounce it Kiev, which is why you're hearing that from the witnesses.
Oh, okay, good. Well, then we should all pronounce it Kiev.
So
I hereby decree.
People have either learned something, or we've simply passed along more misinformation here on the Bulwark Podcast. So where do you come down on this on the question of impeachment? Without being, I think you and I both share the. Do you want to, you know, cop to cynicism and that look, he's not going to be removed. The House is going to vote. We're going to go through the kabuki dance, and then he's going to claim exoneration. But as the evidence comes out about what happened, which I think seems very clear and I think seems very, very consistent, does it rise to the level of an impeachable offense?
I think it does. However, being a cynic, I agree that this entire process is a kind of theater. But I would argue it's a necessary kind of theater in some ways, in the same way that it was with Clinton, because Clinton, the lie under oath is what most people were wound up about with Bill Clinton. And I think in this case, it's this idea that you would use your power to influence or hold hostage a foreign government's funding in order to dig up dirt on a political rival. That strikes me as precisely the kind of worrisome abuse of office that our founders would have recognized immediately, particularly because it does involve enlisting the services of a foreign country or threatening those of a foreign country, and one that in fact is in some form of you know, anxiety about its status and threatened by a rival. So I do think it's an impeachable offense. My concern, of course, is that, you know, this was always has been meant to be a rare occurrence. Let's hope it remains so. And I do think the best thing, the way our system works best, the most egregious the most egregious person should still be voted out of office, because that means most of the country has said we do not want this person running our country. So, I mean, the ideal situation is they impeach him, he stays in, he might claim, you know, victory, but then he gets, you know, massively voted out of office in 2020. That's ideal, I think, in terms of how our system works. But yeah, I think there was a sense that I had a lot more skepticism about the Mueller report stuff, but on this, it seems a pretty straightforward abuse of power.
No, I completely agree with you and your take on all of this, that it is necessary to go through this, because the Constitution very specifically provides for this kind of accountability. And all of this rhetoric about it being a coup just ignores the fact that, no, this is in the Constitution as much as the Electoral College is in the Constitution. And right. There is this question of whether anyone is above the law. Now, on the Mueller report, I thought the stuff about obstruction of justice was pretty damning. But I think that we're seeing that playing out in real time as well. And it's worth mentioning that one of the articles of impeachment against Richard Nixon was his attempts to obstruct Congress. And we're seeing this clearly, that we are seeing obstruction and a cover-up in real time by the Trump administration. And I think the Democrats are actually probably making the right decision by just, you know, rolling ahead as opposed to being bogged down. On the other hand, I do think that too much haste is a problem. Just a couple of points here. Number one, obviously, the Republicans are going to continue to complain about the lack of due process and that they're not able to call the witnesses they want. Their case, I think, is dramatically weakened by the fact that the Trump administration is blocking access to key witnesses in this, telling people do not cooperate. If there was exculpatory evidence, if they thought that this testimony would exonerate the president, they would be beating a path to Capitol Hill. The fact that they have basically said, no, we do not want you to testify under oath, we are not going to cooperate, I think, you know, does suggest that they have a consciousness that this would not go well for them. One other point, Greg Sargent, who is a, shall we say, left of center columnist for the Washington Post, made that I thought was interesting. So much of what's happened, whether it's Russia or all the other scandals involving the Trump administration, is that they're not done in secret. They're done like right in front of your face, and sometimes we miss that. And this whole question of, did Trump want Ukraine to go after the Bidens, or was he more interested in some sort of global corruption? You know, Donald Trump corruption fighter, right? But and one of the points that Greg Sargent made yesterday was that, look, you have a $10 million ad campaign that the Trump campaign has just launched, focused on quote unquote Biden corruption in Ukraine. It's just basically saying, yes, this is exactly what I'm interested in. This is exactly what I want to talk about. And the fact that they put $10 million behind that particular talking point is this screaming smoking gun. But it's like we keep looking for something else when the president's out there tweeting, going, yes, I did it. Yes, of course I put pressure on them. Yes, hello. You know, yes, I am going to tamper with the witnesses. All of this stuff. Okay, so let's switch gears, but I want to talk about presidential politics, including Elizabeth Warren and a piece that you wrote in commentary last week about the resurrection of the Equal Rights Amendment, which, boy, that seems like just a flashback. I have to, you know, the last time, you know, we talked about that was, what, in the 1970s?
Yeah, it's back. It's like, it's...
Well, I want you to explain that, but first, let's get a word from our sponsor. Did you know that 70% of people say they want to use natural products, but only 2% do? That's why Grove Collaborative makes finding healthy, affordable, effective products easy and convenient. And now, more than 500,000 American households shop Grove for their healthy home essentials. Grove Collaborative is the online marketplace that delivers all natural home, beauty, and personal products directly to you. They take the guesswork out of going green. Every Grove product is guaranteed to be good for you, your family, your home, and the planet. My first box arrived, and it had just an incredible array of products that my wife and I are going to be trying out. I mean, it is an amazing smorgasbord of choices. Then they deliver all of your home essentials right to your front door, and they have this huge selection of sustainable plant-based products, including all the big brands that I love and I trust, like Mrs. Meyers and Method. Everything they carry is safer for you, better for the planet, and it really works. In place of the harsh chemicals, they use natural ingredients that smell fresh and leave your house sparkling. Look, we're all busy. I certainly am. And I know that I don't have time to waste buying detergent and toilet paper, and neither do you. So give it a try and get some me time back in your day. Because with Grove, you don't have to shop multiple stores or search endlessly online to get all the natural goods you need for you and your family. They have everything that I need in one place, which... I don't want to spend a lot of time doing this, but I want to get quality stuff. So, and they have the best selection of natural home and personal care products. Things for the house, my grandkids, my dog, even some fun personal things for me. So join more than 500,000 families who trust Grove Collaborative to make their homes happier and healthier. Plus, the shipping is fast and free on your first order. For a limited time, when listeners go to grove.co/bulwark, you'll get a free 5-piece gift set from Mrs. Meyer's and festive holiday scents like peppermint or Iowa pine. So go to grove.co/bulwark to get this exclusive holiday offer. That's grove.co/bulwark. Today's episode is brought to you by Quip, makers of the Quip electric toothbrush. This is something I actually have. I've been using it for months now, and they want you to know that the one single discovery that matters most for your dental care is simply this. If you have good habits, you're good. That means brushing for 2 minutes twice a day and flossing regularly, no matter what brand you use. But Quip makes that simple, starting with an electric toothbrush, refillable floss, and anti-cavity toothpaste. Quip's electric brush has sensitive sonic vibrations with a built-in timer and 30-second pulses to guide a full and even clean. And the Quip floss dispenser comes with pre-marked string to help you use just enough. Plus, Quip delivers fresh brush heads, floss, and toothpaste refills to your door every 3 months with free shipping, so your routine is always right. You never run out. You don't have to run to the store. It comes right to you. Join more than 3 million healthy mouths and get Quip today, starting at $25. And if you go to getquip.com/sykes, that's S-Y-K-E-S, right now, you'll get your first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/sykes, S-Y-K-E-S. Let me spell that out. GETQUIP.com/sykes. Quip, the good habits company. Okay, we're back with Christine Rosen of Commentary Magazine. So you have written extensively about feminism. And I wanted to get your take on something that seems to be emerging in the presidential campaign, that criticism of Elizabeth Warren is sexist. If there's a suggestion that she's too angry or that she's elitist, and there is that sort of pushback. Now, I mean, let's stipulate that there is sexism, and that women political figures are sometimes held to unfair standards. But give me your take on Elizabeth Warren, who seems to be in this moment, and when we're talking on a day in which there are new polls out that would suggest that her momentum has stalled out. So I'm guessing that there's going to be more defensiveness. Is Elizabeth Warren the victim of sexism?
No. Elizabeth Warren is the beneficiary of a sustained and ridiculously over-the-top fawning media that has propped her up from the moment she announced her candidacy. I mean, if you look at the kinds of stories that have been done, the kind of puff pieces and the, like, you know, the sweet, you know, stories about her and her husband, and there was practically an entire feature in the Post at one point about her dog. I mean, it was just, it's so over the top because she is the perfect candidate for the kind of Acela Corridor media elite. They love this kind of candidate, right? She's always talking policy and plans. And oh, she's so energetic. And oh, she's a fighter and this, that, and the other. Oh, and she's a woman and we need a woman president. It's time. Put women, you know, in the Oval Office, et cetera, et cetera. She actually, the thing in general that gets me annoyed about claims that female candidates are held to different standards than men on the issue of likability is that it's simply not true. If you look at the coverage of male candidates and how voters respond to their likability factor, it's similar as it is with female candidates. I mean, is he the guy you want to sit around and have a beer with, for example? But Elizabeth Warren has a particular tick that I think has emerged and reminds some voters, at least some I've spoken to, about something they disliked as well about Hillary Clinton. I don't think it has to do with them being female. I think it has to do with the problem of coming across as condescending and sanctimonious. And there are plenty of male candidates who do that, too. I always thought Obama was kind of sanctimonious as a candidate. He toned it down a little bit as president, but, you know, there was always a kind of sanctimony. And in a time when populist feeling is running pretty high, and being called an elite is a slur, and there's a very small number of swing voters who will decide the next election. These are things that Democrats should worry about with regard to Elizabeth Warren's candidacy. She, you know, she's got some troublesome problems with the truth in terms of her own personal history. She has problems explaining the details of her plans. She's extremely defensive with her fellow Democrats when she's been challenged on them in a debate setting. These are all things that would make a candidate appear unlikable to one of these kind of swing voters. So I don't think it's sexism. I think it's actually the combative style that she's decided to embrace. And that's fine. That's her choice. But to embrace that style and to go on the attack and to refuse to answer questions and to, you know, kind of call people unfair for even asking them, you can't do that and then pivot when you're criticized for it and cry sexism. You just can't do that.
There seems to be something inherently arrogant about having a plan that would reorder the economy in everyone's life because she knows better than all of us. I mean, just saying that on a policy basis, the Medicare for All plan just does not seem to be playing outside of that wonk circle. But, you know, you're right. I do think the fact that people do kind of roll their eyes at some of her pretensions is not simply because she is a woman. But I think the media is going to be the last. The Washington-based media will be the last folks to realize what she has done to herself politically. And Josh Krasauer had this piece in the National Journal that I mentioned. It's, you know, saying, hey, you know, based on news of the last week, you think it's Biden's campaigns on life support, right? You know, with all these reports of other people getting into the race and everything. And he says, a funny thing happened amid all of this establishment media angst. The latest round of early state polls shows Biden ahead in 3 of 4 states. He's ahead in New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. He's building momentum and a double-digit lead in Nevada. He's benefiting from a progressive split in New Hampshire. He's been dominating in South Carolina. If anybody needs to be worried about alarming trends line, it's Elizabeth Warren. Her tortured explanation for how she'd pay for a government-run healthcare system was widely panned by the press. And so it did seem like on cue, the complaints that she was being treated unfairly because she was a woman came out.
Well, and I think the flip side of this is that we should want female candidates to be angry and combative when they're running for office. And I think, you know, Klobuchar, for example, has not been whining about being treated in a sexist way. And she's had extremely harsh media coverage. She's been called all kinds of things, I think, including the word harsh. She was extremely tough during the Kavanaugh hearings. And I think she has shown a kind of combative female presence on the trail that if you're a feminist, shouldn't you kind of admire? I mean, I don't, but it will be judged accordingly. And she has not been a media darling. And so she's been judged fairly harshly, but I have not heard her complaining so much. The one thing I did hear her say about, you know, she was a little cranky that Buttigieg was yes. About Buttigieg's experience. And she said, you know, she sort of said, oh, if there's a woman, you know, he would never be getting this kind of attention. I don't think that's true. Look at the attention Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez gets, and she has very little experience, but she gets tons of coverage and, you know, exposure. So I don't think this is a sexism problem, although I agree with you, you know, with the caveat that sexism is still a problem in the culture, but it's not the problem for Elizabeth Warren.
Well, you know, I actually like Amy Klobuchar and kind of wonder when she's going to get her moment, but she got annihilated by that complaint about Buttigieg saying, you know, if a woman had his level of experience, they wouldn't be on the stage. And of course, veterans groups immediately pushed back and said, look, this is a guy who had, you know, boots on the ground experience in Afghanistan. Are you suggesting that if rather than serving his country and putting, you know, his life on the line, that he should have been running for office? And that did not play well at all. So your piece in Commentary seems to relate to what we just talked about. Is it was headlined Fragility Feminism, and you know, making the point that while, you know, feminists often, you know, talk about themselves as, you know, being badasses and nasty women, that you say that new feminists are surprisingly fragile. They would rather wallow in grievance and victimhood and evoke intersectional ideology to justify their victimization. This seems to have been coming on for some time. But you write this in the context of bringing the ERA back. I mean, didn't the ERA like die in 1979? I mean, literally.
Yes, it's like the Frankenstein of constitutional amendments, right? It's the only one that just can't animate into life, and there's a reason for that. And it's not just because Phyllis Schlafly got annoyed and started a successful campaign to drive a stake through the ERA's heart. It's that, you know, women do have equality under the eyes of the law. This would be a symbolic amendment. Most of the people who support it when pressed will admit that, in fact, that it would have very little practical implications for women, except for one thing, which is this. It doesn't, by the way, use the word women. It uses the word sex. Hmm. So how we define sex now versus how we defined it in the 1970s when it was almost ratified and back in 1923 when suffragette Alice Paul first proposed this amendment is very different. And so it's incumbent on the people who are insisting we should pass this amendment that they define what sex means, because we're legally now wrangling. Does that mean transgender women? Does it mean transgender men? Does it mean sexual orientation? All of these questions are unresolved right now constitutionally, many of them. And I think that if we're going to add a very vaguely worded amendment to the Constitution that's meant to improve the plot of women's lives, then we need to be extremely specific about what we mean by sex. And that's the opposite of what the proponents of this revived ERA are doing. Also, legally, there's a lot of hurdles they need to overcome.
Well, yeah, let's get a little wonky because I'm trying to remember, you know, how this all played out. So Jerry Nadler, who's the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, says that mm-hmm. he's going to push a bill eliminating the deadlines for states to adopt the amendment. Now, would that be retroactive? Because my understanding is it was one state short of the 38 needed for ratification, but there was a deadline in 1982. So Congress had actually extended the deadline. There's a specific date by which it fell short by one state. So are they thinking that they will just extend it and so we're still one state short? Or?
So they're not actually one state short. There's a couple of complicating factors. One is that there was a federal case about whether it was constitutional for Congress to even extend the deadline. The court actually said, no, it was unconstitutional. They didn't have the right to extend a deadline for ratification. The second problem is that I think it's four or five states have rescinded their original ratifications. And there's a question as to the constitutionality of whether they're allowed to do that. So there are actually a number of specific legal issues that would have to be resolved. It's not Virginia ratifying the amendment does not make it constitutional. Yes. And even Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg recently at a Georgetown Law panel conversation said, she said she'd definitely like to see the ERA pass, but we'll have to start from the beginning and get all the states to vote for it. So she was signaling, I think, and obviously I would certainly trust her to be thinking about this from a constitutional standpoint. She was saying, yeah, we should do it, but it would have to start from scratch again. And I think a lot of there's a pretty compelling constitutional argument that that's what would have to be done.
It would be so ugly. Okay, one other story that's getting lost, at least so far today, unfortunately, because I think it's a very big deal, and we'll talk about it on tomorrow's podcast as well. This rather extraordinary. Actually, now my head is going to all these other stories that in you know Earth 2.0 would be huge, including from the Roger Stone trial that seemed to have come up with evidence that the president lied under oath in the Mueller investigation about what he knew and who he talked to about WikiLeaks. But of course, you know, let's leave that aside for the moment. This joint press conference between Donald Trump and Erdogan of Turkey a month after Turkey rolls into Syria. And it looks like he is going to give him all kinds of not simply the love that has become routine for authoritarian thugs, but an extraordinarily generous trade deal, workarounds on other sanctions. And it's a rather remarkable moment that Erdogan behaves badly, extremely badly, and he is rewarded by this event today that even Republicans who've gone along with everything else are saying how totally inappropriate this is. Mm-hmm. You know, it is remarkable. It is kind of Donald Trump saying, these are my buddies. I don't care what you say, and I'm going to rub your nose in it.
So there was, I was literally driving through the security presence around, Embassy Row on Massachusetts Avenue, where 2 years ago, Turkish thugs beat up Americans and others on a public sidewalk at Erdogan's go-ahead, and very little was done about that. And so this is a thug regime in many ways, and the fact that Trump is embracing him and they're behaving like thugs, right? So Erdogan seems to have evidently during this press conference kind of hinted that, if you don't give me what I want, I'm going to go get Russian jets. I mean, it's kind of appalling. And at least some Republicans are saying it's appalling. And this policy in Syria and with the Kurds, this is really not acceptable American foreign policy, in my opinion. And I think that the timing of this is also, it was poorly timed and too close to the fallout from what's been going on in Syria. So I'll be curious to see if the public keeps track of this as well as they should, given all the impeachment circus going on. But no, I agree. I think it's kind of appalling.
Well, this is the time warp that we're living in, that a week from now, will we even remember this?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's because things move ahead. The betrayal of the Kurds, which seemed like a real turning point in Mideast history and in the U.S. role in the Middle East, now seems like, wow, that was a long time ago. But interesting that Trump would bring it back into focus himself, that you would think that he would want to pass on from all of this. And of course, this does become a recurring theme of this administration, which apparently he has no shame about or no embarrassment about whatsoever, which is his weak spot for authoritarians, his love affair with Vladimir Putin, his admiration for people like Duterte in the Philippines, his willingness to do Vladimir Putin's bidding. And this is one of the strange things about what's happening now with the impeachment, is that ultimately all roads lead back to Vladimir Putin. I mean, all roads lead back through Ukraine. Ukraine is at war with Russia. And so many of the things that Trump has done here in this case, in this scandal that's leading to his impeachment, have the effect of strengthening Vladimir Putin. His position in Syria has the effect of strengthening Vladimir Putin and the Russian presence in the Middle East. And Donald Trump appears to be utterly unembarrassed by one story, one decision after another that has that consequence.
I don't even know that he is making the connection. I mean, I think that he really is. I think he truly believes that he could outsmart Putin, and that the idea that he's being played by Putin, which many of us believe he is, doesn't cross his mind. And I think that's a character weakness. He's obviously surrounded by advisors who allow him to continue to believe his own strategic genius. And that's a problem, because we have long, as a country, had a foreign policy that is the opposite of the way that Donald Trump is conducting it now. Certainly the Republicans have. I mean, I've had a lot of issues with Obama's foreign policy, but this is not Republican foreign policy. It's Trump foreign policy. And whether Republican foreign policy ideas can survive the Trump years is an open question.
All right. So speaking of, I didn't give you a heads up that we were going to talk about this. So if you want to pass on this is completely fine. But I started thinking about my Earth 2.0 stories that would be important we'd be focusing on. Stephen Miller, who is the Rasputin, the White House Rasputin on immigration issues, apparently sent out multiple emails that expressed his ties to or his admiration for certain white nationalists. In any other administration, any other figure, the kinds of document dump that we just saw about Stephen Miller would be career ending. And yet it's my gut sense is that this is not going to result in that particular weird homunculus being removed from office. But it really does, shed some light on the toxic mindset of the White House. And one of those moments where you knew that it was bad, but it's much, much worse. I mean, this is a guy who's really on the fringe of the alt-right And now he is the guy whispering into the ear of the president of the United States. And it's pretty horrific.
It is. I will say Stephen Miller's very lucky in his enemies, because the people attacking him are people like Ilhan Omar, who has her own issues with regard to, you know, she basically sent out a tweet immediately saying, "See, I told you so. I said he was a white nationalist." To which my response would be, "Really, you're the wrong messenger for accusing people of bias."
Sit this one out. Sit this one out.
And same with AOC. I'm sort of like, you know what, girls, stick to your squad and let a grown up deal with this. But I agree. I mean, I think it also shows a particular moment in our culture where the sort of toxic ideas that spread online become mainstream very quickly, and become mainstreamed into policymaking much more quickly than they used to. I mean, this is it's kind of like, you know, the sort of the right wing fringe that, you know, Buckley and others tried to force out of the Republican Party and whatnot. It's like the fringe is now still the fringe, but they're making the policies. So that's a new thing. That's actually a really new thing. And it's worrisome thing.
It is worrisome. But of course, you know, speaking of being fortunate in his opponents, this document dump about Stephen Miller was done by the Southern Poverty Law Center, which has a very, 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 should we say, mixed record. Very, very sketchy record. Lots of conservatives justifiably very, very skeptical of them. However, they actually have the receipts here. And Katie Hughes,
he talks about Nazi eugenics laws. I mean, it's insane.
Well, this is something. There's something else going on here that you have these folks from the really far extremes of the fever swamps. And I'm not trying to downplay how serious this is, because there are, you know, they're neo-Nazis out there. Mm-hmm. And they do feel emboldened in this particular period. I think it's really interesting watching how they've kind of turned on the Trumpian right. We had a couple of incidents where they've disrupted events by Charlie Kirk and by Don Jr., Donald Trump Jr., because they're not extreme enough. They're not out there. And there's a couple of these guys like Nick Fuentes, and I certainly don't want to raise his profile, but this guy is pretty much a Nazi, and I'm sorry, he's done videos, you know, of, you know, mocking the Holocaust. I mean, there shouldn't be any debate about his place, and we're starting to see some folks on the right beginning to sort of defend him on, you know, extending this line that we shouldn't break bad on any of our folks, otherwise we sound like leftists.
Well, so this is an interesting point. It's an important point too, because I think one of the reasons that argument thrives is because you have seen the left for a very long time use the phrase white nationalist to apply to, you know, a guy who likes to play a first person shooter game and, you know, talk smack with his friends. So you've seen a kind of dumbing down, a watering down of the term for so long that then when you come face to face with a real white nationalist, there's a skepticism by a lot of people on the right, because they say, oh, this is just, it's like the phrase toxic masculinity. You know, people are like, oh, everything's toxic, you know, so it means nothing. So I do think that this is one of those examples where, you know, going back to Orwell, like, language matters. How we use these labels, how we define them, and how we apply them are very important for precisely this reason. So that you can call the white nationalist a white nationalist when you find one and see one and there's evidence of one. Versus the kind of the degradation of language that's occurred. And the right is guilty of this, too. I'm not saying it's just the left. But in the case of something like white nationalism, it's been used as a blanket term to cover people who just disagree with the left. They aren't, in fact, white nationalists.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we missed a lot of stuff that really was going on here. But the relentless, you know, invocation of you're a racist did lead to that sort of, you know, shoulder shrugging, eye rolling. OK, here we go again. But I do think it's fascinating watching how the Trumpian right, which has spent its time nurturing these crocodiles in the bathtub, suddenly are shocked to find out that they've grown large and they're crawling out, and they may be among the first to be eaten. So I don't know. That seems to be
Don Jr. breaking a sweat on stage was kind of worth seeing. So I have to say, I got a little guilty pleasure out of watching that.
and his girlfriend doing the mom voice. Christine Rosen, thank you so much for joining us today on the Bulwark Podcast. Appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. Our episode today was brought to you by Grove Collective and Quip. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we will do this all over again.